From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Music can do many things. It can soothe us, entertain us, can make us smile. Music can make us dance or even make us cry. A song can inspire a nation to war or be a symbol of peace. Music can transform your life. Music can change the world. And when music isn't there, the lack of it can hold your soul captive. And then, when it comes back again, music can rise like a phoenix from the ashes of war. You're listening to music from the Sierra Leone Refugee All-Stars. As their name suggests, the band was formed in a dusty refugee camp by a group of musicians from Sierra Leone, fleeing the brutality and bloodshed of their country's savage civil war. Now, only a few years later, the band is touring the world, a living example of the redemptive power of music persevering over the unspeakable horrors of war. Anne Strangechamp spoke to the band's youngest member, a young man named Black Nature, about how he came to be a refugee all-star.
In 2002, after we had some few instruments donated by an organization, a Canadian organization called CECI in the refugee camp, they gave us like few instruments like the guitar and like the drum and the amplifier and the microphone. So we started playing in the refugee camp. At that time, we started becoming, you know, really, really known among our refugee brothers, because whenever we started playing, you will see like hundreds, you know, high and low numbers of people will come around and start to dance to our music and forget about the pain and struggle, you know. So,
and how old were you at the time?
I think I was around 15.
And you'd been living in the refugee camps, what, since you were maybe 11 or so?
Yeah, since when I was 11.
It's a long time.
Yeah, but yeah.
You lost your parents in the war?
Correct, yeah. Yeah, I lost, actually, my mom, they were like the first victim when the war started. And a few years when finally the war reaches the city, that's when I lost my dad. For me personally, I was taken away by the rebels because my dad was actually captured in front of me. He was taken in a car and he was burned alive in front of me.
Oh.
And that was the point where I was arrested also by a group of rebels and taken away. I was actually among the kids who were carrying loads and just the materials that they use.
So they tried to turn you into a child soldier?
Right. So I was with them for a while and I get the opportunity to escape from them and start to join other families. And finally, I find myself in a border between Guinea and Sierra Leone.
You know, the level of violence, of brutality in that war was so extreme. It's really hard to understand what kind of people could inflict so much pain on innocent civilians.
Yeah, that's the thing about our civil war, you know, like, it seems like when the war started, the people who were fighting against the government, who were the rebels, they said that we are going to fight for the progress of the civilians. They were going to fight for the civilians. And a few years, things just turned into bitterness and they started, you know, turning against the civilians, killing and rape and burning of houses and cutting of hands. And, you know, the more the war continued and it became really, really crazy war, most of the people don't even know why they were fighting for, even the rebels.
It makes me think of one track in particular on your new album, Ja Mercy. I don't know if the lyrics speak to what we've been talking about, but you know, it seems like that's one of the questions that informs that particular song. At the beginning of the lyrics, I just want to know what you're fighting for.
Yeah, well, bad things are going around the world, you know, we can't figure it out and try to stop it. And it's high time for us to ask Jah, you know, which is God, you know, to send down his mercy and help us figure it out. Jah mercy.
I just wanna know what I'm fighting for.
It has been always so extraordinary about your music and so moving to people who find out about your group is that after all of what you lived through, your music is still mostly upbeat, even joyous. Where do you find the joy?
Well, that joy just comes from, you know, our heart and forgiveness and love.
Yeah, but where do you find the strength to forgive or to feel love after you've watched the people you loved most in the world be destroyed by other human beings?
Well, I found it through music. I found it through music. You know, when I started playing music, that was the time I get to realize that after all what has happened, I don't have to continue to carry that anger and pain in my mind. So I just have to release that and continue my hopes and dreams.
We are the living stone. Some of them are stepping stone. We are the cornerstone. We are the rolling stone. We are the living stone. Some of them are stepping stone. We are the cornerstone. We are the rolling stone. Ooh, yeah, na, 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 na.
Do you still feel like you still need music to help you continue to recover in your own life? Is your music still healing things in you?
Yeah, it's 100% healing things to me. And it's something that I'm going to continue the rest of my life because I have great passion of music. I know what music has done for me. And, you know, he changes my life totally by, you know, just I have the opportunity to travel around the world and see incredible people, stand in front of thousands of people and meet people and talk about life, talk about what has happened to me, like what we're doing right now, you know, like it will take me month to month for me to think about what has happened to me, because by talking to you right now, I feel like, wow, this is real, you know, like I know I'm talking about my life and stuff, but trust me, when I go back home, I'll think about something else. I'm not just going to be sitting there thinking about what has happened to me.
Is there a song you choose to end with?
Actually, Birmani is a song that talks about family, which is basically Birmani in Creole. In English means trouble. The song talks about how a family should respect each other, especially the mom and the dad. Where there is no respect, there will be trouble, there will be fighting, there will be disrespectful, and there will not be love. So that song is trying to express that families should love each other, especially the mom and the dad, so that for the better future of the kids.
Peace begins at home.
Right.
Hey, thank you so much for talking today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mama le moya mai
Salaya tarati kapai
eh Salaya tarati my moembo Salaya tarati kapa Mama le moya mai
po 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 Bermani wakanyo
Black Nature is the youngest member of the Sierra Leone Refugee All-Stars, and Strange Champ spoke with him. The band's latest album is called Rise and Shine. Later this hour, the complicated politics of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony.
We know that Hitler liked to hear it on his birthday every year. And on the other hand, it would seem to express a point of view that was diametrically opposed to what Hitler stood for.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Thank you.
Reading the news, you might think that Christians hate Muslims, Muslims hate Jews, Jews hate Muslims. Can't we all just get along? Well, we can. We have. Dwight Reynolds is a professor of Arabic language and literature at the University of California. He told Steve Paulson that we all, Christian, Muslim, and Jew, got along during a period of religious tolerance in Al-Andalus.
The Arabs conquer Spain, or rather Muslim forces invade Iberia in 711. We don't know much about the music for the first 150 years or so, but already by the early 9th century, mid-9th century, we know of a thriving musical culture in the court of Cordoba, which was the capital of Moorish Spain. And in that court, we have actually many anecdotes and interesting biographies of musicians of various different backgrounds, Jewish, Arab, Christian, perhaps even African, we're not 100% sure about one particular figure, who all perform, mix, and end up over the period of 100, 150 years creating a new type of music that was different from the Arab music of North Africa and the Eastern Mediterranean.
And wasn't Cordoba at that time one of the most sophisticated, one of the most cosmopolitan cities in the world?
Indeed. It was the largest city in Western Europe. And it was known far and wide as essentially the most extravagantly civilized and cultured spot in the region. There's a very famous text written by a nun who is writing in Eastern Europe, and she refers to Cordoba by its title, The Ornament of the World.
And you're saying that music was an essential part of that culture.
Indeed. Poetry and music together, other than architecture and gardens, are perhaps the most enduring legacy of Muslim Spain.
Was this considered religious music?
Not what was actually being sung in the court. And now some of it would be, and some of it certainly they would sing praise songs to the Prophet Muhammad, for example, but the vast majority of what was sung in the courtly tradition was much more secular poetry, descriptions of gardens, descriptions of lovers meeting in gardens, having trysts, etc., descriptions of the beloved. But there's an interesting thing about Arabic poetry almost from its very beginnings, but that certainly develops as Sufism, the mystical branch of Islam, develops, and that is that they take over these same poetic images and reinterpret them in mystical ways. So the beloved in a Sufi poem is not a physical human being, but rather God himself. And of course, one pines away and wants to be close to the beloved, which is an expression of one's desire to be unified with the Godhead. If you achieve a very high level of spiritual attainment, the wine that's constantly mentioned in these secular poems and the intoxication is not actual wine or intoxication, but the great ecstasy one feels in worshiping and loving God. So from that point on, it's almost impossible to say that any one particular lyric is or is not religious.
One musician in particular who performed at the court of Cordoba, Ziryab?
Ziryab is perhaps, well, almost without doubt, the most famous musician of the Islamic Middle Ages. There's one other figure in Baghdad who might rival him, but otherwise Ziryab, at least for North Africans and people who like modern Andalusian music, he is the major figure. We don't know much about his origins at all. He was trained in Baghdad, but we are told from the very beginning that he was a black slave. So it's possible that he was of African origin. It's possible that he was born in Baghdad, but of slave parentage. Some have tried to speculate that he might have been Baluchi or even Indian, but we know that he was not just dark-skinned, but black. He's constantly always referred to as being black. He supposedly trains under the greatest master in Baghdad and has a row with his master there. He gets an opportunity to perform in front of the Sultan. And the Sultan likes this young fellow so much that his teacher is jealous and afraid that Ziryab might take his place as the Sultan's favorite singer. So in the biographies that have come down to us, he basically takes Ziryab aside one night and says, "This town isn't big enough for the two of us. Either you leave now peaceably, or I'll make sure that you don't live to sing another song." And so he supposedly fled and went across North Africa. And we do know that he arrived in Moorish Spain in 822. And when he arrived with his entourage, and, you know, he began to sing before the Emir of Cordoba. And instantly, the Emir was completely taken with him and gave him outrageous amounts of money and put him up in, you know, in a house that abutted upon the actual royal palace. And
didn't he even have a look, like the way he parted his hair and
absolutely.
All of that?
With the biographer tells us that until that time, the Moors, the Andalusian Muslims, all, male and female, parted their hair straight down the middle and let it hang loose down onto both sides. And we know that Ziryab is described as having had bangs that were cut straight across his eyebrows, and that his hair was tucked behind his ears, but that he had two spit curls that came down in front of his ears. So in the end, he becomes far more than a musician. He is the arbiter of taste in the court of Cordoba. And as I've written before, the emir might have had rule in all matters of state, but Ziryab held rule in all matters of taste. Allah yaqul al-kha'inin
ala shia. So here was this remarkable flowering of culture, this coming together of these different cultural traditions, different religious traditions, mm-hmm. and this lasted for what, several centuries?
Yes. One thing that we can note in the biography of Ziryab is that the Emir of Cordoba sent his chief musician, his head musician, down to the southern coast to meet him when he landed after crossing the Straits of Gibraltar. And that man's name was Mansur ibn Buhlul, and he was Jewish. And at the same time, one of the famous singing girls in the court when Ziryab arrived was a woman who was given the name Qalam, which is a pen for writing calligraphy with. And what we know about her is that she was originally a Basque Christian. So at one and the same time, we have a Basque Christian singing girl, a Jewish head musician, and a perhaps African musician fresh from Baghdad who become the three central figures. And this, as you said, continues for several centuries.
So when did this culture of tolerance start to collapse?
As the Christians reconquered the Iberian Peninsula, there were a variety of different reactions to that because they ended up with Muslim indigenous populations and Jewish indigenous populations now under Christian control. And they had to rework in their minds what the status of these groups was going to be. 1492, of course, is the end of Islamic Spain, or the fall of Granada. And it's the fall of Granada that frees up money for the royal treasury to pay Christopher Columbus to go off to the New World. But as just a demonstration of what happens to these people, in 1492, in the surrender agreement, and soon after the surrender, Jews were expelled. This was the reaction of their most Catholic majesties, Ferdinand and Isabella. And so it led to a very, you know, an awful act in that direction. And then Muslims were promised that they could practice their faith in peace and in freedom for all time, for eternity. Well, it turns out that eternity lasted 10 years. And in 1502, people were forcibly converted from, they became conversos, they were converted from Islam to Christianity. Now, they were given the opportunity to leave. And many people ask me, well, if they really loved their faith, why didn't they leave? Well, there were a few little conditions if you wanted to leave. One was that you had to abandon your children. Because, from the Catholic Church's point of view, these were children whose souls had to be saved by turning them over to Christ. And so, as an adult, if you were going to be, you know, from their point of view, if you were going to, you know, cling to your sinfulness and your wrongful path, that was fine, but you shouldn't be allowed to imperil a child's salvation. The other thing was that you couldn't take any gold, silver, or jewels, and you could only leave with what you carried on your back. So you basically could only take your clothes, and you would have to abandon your children. So people stayed, they became converted, and through the entire 16th century can witness sort of like the tightening of the screw. Little bit by little bit, there are attempts to outlaw the use of Arabic language, outlaw the possession of Arabic books, outlaw the singing of Arabic songs, outlaw the use of musical instruments that were used by the Moors, outlaw the clothing that were worn by the Moors. In other words, in order to make them good Christians, they basically had to become Spanish as well.
So the effect of all of this was that Spain became a Christian country and lasted that way well into the modern day.
Right.
The music of religious tolerance is still with us today. There are thousands of these songs that have been passed down through the oral tradition, performed regularly in Syria, Morocco, Yemen, and Algeria. Also, it lives with the Sephardic Jews around the world. And it has started to be performed again in Spain. Dwight Reynolds is a professor of Arabic language and literature at the University of California. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Anjali Kidjo was deemed by Time magazine Africa's diva. She's the continent's most celebrated female musician. Her latest album, Oyo, is her exploration of the African diaspora caused by slavery. This Grammy-winning artist left her native Benin for political reasons almost 20 years ago. Yet she told Steve Paulson that Benin is still at the heart of her music.
I've done a lot of songs, and it was painful to go through all the songs and left some out and pick some. Because I've listened to so many different variety of music that it will take my lifetime to be covering all the songs that I've listened to when I was growing up. But those songs were the one that really stands for what it meant to me and linked to the memory that I had of my father, because my father passed away 2 years ago. And one of the beliefs of my father is to give to his children education and to open the world to them through books and music, because he was not rich enough. It was the only one salary home. My mom was not working. My dad was the only one having a paycheck every month with 10 children to send to school. But he always managed to bring us, every time we say there's a new album out there we wanted, he makes sure we get it. And when my brother decided to do music, to put together the first modern music group that existed in Benin, my father bought the instrument and free a room, which was a challenge in itself because there were not that much room available for everybody, but we accepted to share the rooms in order to free that room for rehearsal.
Oh!
Isn't one of the songs on this album, I'm not sure how you say it, Achahun?
Achahun.
Achahun. Isn't that a rendition of the very first song you performed on stage?
Yeah, in my mother theater group. My mother put together the only theater troupe that ever existed in Benin, and the new generation is trying to revive a theater in Benin. And in that theater group of my mom, there were a little girl that play a really important role in the play, and she has malaria and she couldn't come because she has a lot of fever and she couldn't move out of the bed. And because I've always been so curious, I would be between everybody's leg asking them, what is this? And I knew all the lines. When somebody was saying something wrong, I go, that's not the line. And I was 6 years old and just bitching about everything. And my mom said, you big mouth, that you don't know everything. Now you're going to sing. I'm like, Mom, no, I'm not singing. She goes, yeah. And she dragged me on from under the costumes and put the girl's costume on me. And my eyes start rolling left and right, like, you know, when an animal is trapped and you don't know where to go, that's how I felt. And then she shoveled me on stage. And the first time ever, I can hear all the bones in my body going. And everybody started laughing. I'm like, this is kind of cute. People are laughing. Then let me sing. And I start singing. And since then, I've been hooked. So that was the first song I've ever sung on stage, Achang, when I was 6 years old.
Wow. So right away, when you started singing, you realized, oh, this is kind of cool?
Oh, man, people were laughing, having fun. I'm like, I'm liking this. And I came back and can I go back again? My mom's like, no, go sit. I'm like, oh, man, the fun is too quick.
Now, you said that you left Benin for political reasons. Now, this was a Marxist dictatorship, I think we could say.
Yep.
You couldn't just be an artist? You couldn't be a musician in that country?
No, on the radio in Cotton, you could listen to every different artist. The communist regime changed and said no propaganda, no music from the Western world. And everything just changed from one morning to the other. And it has been clearly said to the Beninese artists, from now on, all you write about is about the revolution, about the communist regime and the people in power. I'm like, hell no, I ain't doing it. In that kind of regime, there's no freedom of speech. So I got to fled because my father was on their radar because they asked him to be part of the government and he said no. And I was on their radar too because they wanted me to use my fame to praise the communism regime. I have nothing against communism and the philosophy and people that believe in it. What I don't believe in is when somebody use a philosophy and ideology to take away from people their freedom. And I'm not gonna buy it. It can be religion. It can be political. I'm not there. I'm out.
So when you left for Paris, your parents were still living in Benin. Were there repercussions on them?
Oh boy. I mean, the repercussions were not only on my family. The custom agent that let me go was a friend of my brother. And when he saw me, he was just like frozen. He said, what are you trying to do? See, I just gotta leave. And he said, okay, I will turn my back, you go. I'm not going to even stamp your passport. Just leave and get to the plane before somebody saw you. So I ran to the plane. And at that time, we didn't need a visa to go to France. And years later, late 90s, when I came back, I saw him. It was his last year as a custom agent. And he told me, I'm so proud of what you have become, that I played a little tiny role in that. But because I let you go, because they find out that he was the one that was there when I left, he did not get any promotion till he retired.
Wow, sobering story. So why did you end up moving from Paris to New York, to Brooklyn?
When I started the trilogy of album tracing back the root of slavery through the diaspora that left Africa, America was the first stop for me. And I came here to write with American singer-songwriter an American artist, for us to start a discussion, because since the drift that slavery have caused, we have never been able to come together and heal that wound. And because the subject of slavery have been put under the rug for so long, no one wants to touch it, and we don't talk about it, the wound will never go away. And the best way that I find was to use music as a vehicle for that. La Cuchoni Langa Zagubuyi Kamo Ndakunkinga Ngawe La Cuchoni Langa
become an international citizen, and you are, in fact, a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador, and you've started your own foundation to help girls back in Africa get an education. Can you tell me about why that is so important to you?
We cannot achieve economical growth, play any role in the global economical world, reduce child mortality at birth, reduce the pandemic of AIDS, fight malaria without girls' education. And mothers start coming to me in different countries where I go in Africa saying, you know what's gonna happen when our daughter finish primary school, right? And I said, yes, I know, but I was not thinking that much ahead. And thanks God, they remind me that if I don't put those girls in secondary education, they're gonna end up being married, which means we have invested during the primary education and we're losing it, because they don't go farther than up in education. And we need highly educated women and boys together to create a different society all over Africa.
Do you see that change really happening in Africa? I mean, is the situation for women much different now than it was when you were growing up?
It's not that changing fast, but it's changing. Because, I mean, you hear young kids now telling you, this is what I want to be. This is what I want to do. And now I'm going to fight for it. Before, it was not like that. The only perspective of future that they had was to be married. It's a long work. We are far away from the complete result that we want. But I said, one child at a time, one step at a time. And if it's only 500,000 of people that we save, it's a lot already all over Africa. But I'm ambitious because I believe in people to help me achieve those goals. Because we're talking about the future. Do you know where your kid's going to end up to? You don't know. So if you don't help the kids in Africa or the kids, underprivileged kids in this country, then you're going to end up facing the consequences sooner or later. For me, helping the children around the planet is just protecting them, for them to know their right, to prepare them to be better politicians, better human beings than the one we had today. Something has to change. And the change will start with education. By example that we started giving the kids home, it's not only schools that educate our children. We have to lead by example, which value that we've cherished the most. If we keep on telling our kids, money is the ultimate goal you have to achieve, you make them monster of greed. So you tell them money is a reward when you work. Don't tell them that's all you have to go for. Zelie.
Hi, Zelie. Angélique Kidjo's latest album is called Oyo. Steve Paulson spoke with her. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
For some of us, the national anthem stirs our patriotic emotions. For others, it's been played too many times and has lost its meaning. But for those in the Mennonite church, the Star-Spangled Banner has great meaning, just not the meaning we're used to. Essayist Beverly Lapp is a Mennonite and professor of music at Goshen College. She explains what the anthem means to her.
Goshen College had until recently never played the national anthem at its sporting events. But that policy changed last year, and now an instrumental version is heard in the opening ritual at certain games. College leaders consider this a gesture of hospitality to our visiting teams and to some of our students who want to hear the anthem. But for many, the change in tradition has raised some profound questions. Mennonites believe in non-resistance even in the face of war, and that it's God, rather than any nation, who deserves our trust and devotion. While the national anthem is a meaningful symbol of patriotic love for many Americans, the act of standing before the flag while listening to a song about a victory in war creates a highly dissonant scenario for Mennonites and other pacifists. As a Mennonite, alum of Goshen College, and now faculty member, my own view is both magnified and clouded when I recently attended the first women's home volleyball game of the new school year. In my eagerness to see our team in action, I temporarily forgot that the national anthem would be part of the opening game rituals. As the playing of the anthem was announced, I felt a jolt and then experienced a series of contradictory thoughts. I could appreciate the elegant setting by the Slovak composer Peter Breiner, who was commissioned to arrange the national anthems for the 2004 Athens Olympics, and was criticized by some for the lack of bombastic flair in his handling of the Star-Spangled Banner. As I stood there, however, I felt a familiar dismay at this change in historical practice and philosophical stance at Goshen College. Each one of us has a story leading to distinct reactions on the anthem issue. Mine includes Mennonite grandparents so worried about the close connection between sports and nationalism that they did not allow their children to participate in school athletics. My parents, uncles, and aunts broke away from this rigidness, but still expected Mennonite institutions to retain distinctive rituals when it came to organized sports and other endeavors. I share this expectation and want Goshen College to send a countercultural message to the militaristic and nationalistic powers that are so overwhelming around us. Not playing the anthem was one key way to bring witness to Jesus' example of challenging these powers. While watching the talent of the Goshen women at the game, I found myself thinking, I do live in this country after all, and I benefit from its appalling military-industrial complex in ways both known and unknown to me. A paradoxical idea emerged from my personal response to the anthem. Might listening to a song where I don't think it fits serve as a reminder to me of how my actions don't always align with my beliefs? I object to war, but my taxes help pay for it. I believe the economic power structures in our world lead to great suffering and injustice, and yet I participate in these systems. Will hearing the anthem before games eventually become so normal and expected that this internal discord will no longer be felt? On a more collective scale, I wonder if repeated exposure to the tension of the anthem at a historic Peace Church college will have an empowering or numbing effect on our commitment to peacemaking and justice. In my teaching, I encourage students to lean into and relish dissonant moments in music. Most, but not all, dissonances lead to resolution. I hope to better understand dissonances beyond music, what they communicate about our values, and whether they should be left in place or resolved with care.
Beverly Lapp is a pianist and professor of music at Goshen College. Goshen College is affiliated with the Mennonite Church. Ludwig van Beethoven's Symphony No. 9 in D minor, Op. 125, is arguably the most recognizable piece of music in history. It may also be the most influential and important composition ever, a cornerstone of Western music as we know it. That's why Harvey Sachs says we must understand the politics surrounding it. Sachs is the author of The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824.
Well, actually, what's particularly interesting about the creation of the Ninth Symphony is that it was composed at a time and in the very place in which Metternich, the Austrian Chancellor, was perfecting the first modern police state. This was in the wake of the French Revolution, which had failed, at least in the short run, and the Napoleonic Wars, and all of the old regime people were coming back into power, or else those who had stayed in power were intent on maintaining it in the firmest possible way. And so it was an era of political repression, and yet here comes this amazing work that is a hymn to human brotherhood and joy, and by extension also to peace.
There's the famous change to the dedication of the Third Symphony, the Eroica, when Napoleon declared himself emperor. Beethoven, well, he believed in the existence of great men, but not in their right to be tyrants, right?
In fact, when he wrote that, he was convinced that Napoleon, and this, of course, was Napoleon's propaganda, that Napoleon was leading the French to bring the French Revolution to all of Europe. Then when Napoleon in 1804 had himself crowned emperor, Beethoven said basically, well, you know, he's just like all the rest of them. He wants power for himself. And so he destroyed the dedication to Bonaparte on the title page of the Eroica Symphony. He crossed it out and wrote, "To the memory of a great man."
What's interesting in some ways is the implication of that. He was someone who would have been interested in a great, benevolent man in charge.
You know, he believed that it was the responsibility of a great leader to make life tolerable and, if possible, good for all of the citizens of any given country.
Which is why, I guess, we so easily believe now that he was a supporter of the rights of man. The idea of the French Revolution would have appealed to him if they could have been more reasonable.
Yes, I think that that's absolutely true. He definitely believed that, well, as the text, Schiller's text of the finale of the Ninth Symphony says, that all men will become brothers. That was the goal of humanity. And that, you know, there would be joy, there would be love. Someday there would be this wonderful new humanity. And it tells us that this is what we should be aiming for. And Beethoven felt very, very strongly about that.
Thinking about the composition of the Ninth, it's one thing in an opera to put forth your political views. I suppose there must have been some opposition even to that. But no one had up to this point written a symphony, anything like the Ninth. And it was something that changed in Beethoven that made him want to add the Ode to Joy to a work to make it clearer what he was attempting to accomplish, don't you think?
Actually, the Ode to Joy by Friedrich von Schiller was a poem that Beethoven had had it in mind to set since he was in his early 20s. And it's generally believed by musicologists that it was actually after he had begun working on his Ninth Symphony. Of course, he didn't know that the Ninth Symphony would be his last, but it was while he was working on it, sketching out the other movements, that it suddenly occurred to him that this was the right place, finally, to make use of that text, which, by the way, he does not use in its integrity. He took excerpts from the poem and rearranged them in ways that suited his musical goals. So what he's doing in the Ninth Symphony is proceeding from the catastrophic first movement to the combative scherzo, the second movement, to the sublime third movement, and then culminating with this expression of joy and brotherhood for humanity. What happens, especially what happens in this finale, the movement that makes use of the text, that has sung voices, the very beginning of the movement, there is a dissonant, catastrophic outburst from the full orchestra, and that's followed by a recitative in which we hear the themes of the first three movements being sort of rejected by the cellos and basses. In other words, he reproposes these old themes from the first three movements and says, essentially, no, he has the orchestra say, no, we don't want to hear these anymore. We don't want to hear the catastrophe of the first movement. We don't want to hear the fighting in the second movement. We don't want to hear the acceptance and the sublimity of the third movement. We've heard all of that. We want something new and different. And then the voice of the bass baritone soloist enters and says, actually in words that Beethoven wrote that don't come from the Schiller text, the bass says, oh, friends, no more these sounds. Let's have something more pleasant and more joyful. And then the orchestra and chorus enter with the full weight of the famous Ode to Joy theme.
Also makes you then wonder what the reaction of the world was to the Ninth, because he was being more explicit about what he wanted the Ninth to mean to listeners. He was, by the use of words, dictating a little more clearly to those of us who don't speak music exactly what he was after. And he must have also thought about who was listening, not just the musical world, but also the political world who would hear this, and for that matter, the public at large.
Yes. By the way, you know, Beethoven also taught. He taught composition and he taught piano at various stages in his career to earn money. He taught wealthy patrons. And his most important patron was the Archduke Rudolf, who was the brother, or one of the many brothers, of the Austrian Emperor. And when the Archduke was, when it was announced that he was going to be appointed, installed as an archbishop in one of the Austrian provinces, Beethoven wrote him, of course, a very nice letter congratulating him. But he adds, by the way, essentially, he says, monarchs have not in the past been known as benefactors of humanity. And he urges the Archduke to go on and do good works and also, of course, to continue with his musical studies. Beethoven, you know, in the repressive atmosphere of Vienna in the 1820s, if Beethoven hadn't been A, so famous, and B, so notoriously eccentric, he could have been jailed for making a statement like that. But I'm sure the Archduke said to his secretary, you know, well, there he is, our friend Beethoven, you know, just file the letter away, which is why we still have it today. He was interested in influencing people like the Archduke, who, of course, was a very important person in the Austrian administration. On the other hand, I don't think he really held out high hopes for his own times. I think he was aiming, in fact, I think he was the first of the important composers who really trained his big artillery at the future. He was writing for future generations, for us, and for people who have come before us and will come after us, whereas his predecessors, generally speaking, were writing for certain specific occasions, and they didn't really think that much of their music was going to survive for a long, long time.
Harvey Sachs is the author of The Ninth, Beethoven and the World in 1824. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for The Soundtrack to War and Peace, program number 103A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Brittany DeAnda, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.